In Formula One, you don't always have the opportunity to win. Do you agree with that take? Okay, well, you want to know who said it?
Yeah, it was Lance Stroll.
Okay, here's what you need to sit with for a second before we get into any of this. Stroll didn't go to France because he just fancied a change of pace. Because the Aston F1 car sure as hell ain't got any. He was reportedly at dinner in Japan with some friends when someone said, "Hey, what if we just did a race in GT? Say, maybe that one in France next week?" And the answer was, yeah. Because yes was easier than the alternative, which was just going home and then thinking about what the next Grand Prix in Miami was going to feel like. Probably not much different to the one in Japan. He then asked Max his thoughts, the four-time world champion, the man who's been describing the 2026 cars as Formula E on steroids since before the season started, and then told the BBC he wasn't even sure whether it was worth it or not anymore. That guy was the one that Lance sought, and he gladly obliged, providing him some contacts in which to make it happen. So now that's two active Formula One drivers who have decided to give GT racing on the side a little bit of a go. See whether or not they can actually reconnect with the thing that they have been aspiring to all of their lives. And they actually followed through, because we've heard plenty of times over the years, even from Max, that, oh, it'd be really, really nice to do Le Mans one day, maybe, perhaps, but they never actually followed through. Oh no, this time they actually did. Within weeks. And sure enough, Lance Stroll rocked up to Paul Ricard and had two buddies from the Aston Martin ecosphere driving an Aston Martin. And you know what? In the grand scheme of things, he didn't disgrace himself. Granted, Stroll's race at Paul Ricard was messy. His team collected over 8 minutes of penalties. All three drivers came away with dirty records. His teammate, Mari Boyer, an Aston Martin Academy driver and ally of Alonso, was all over the place, whereas Stroll picked up blue flag violations and track limit infringements. As a result, they finished 48th. So naturally, I saw the internet light up like a Christmas tree and decided to just condemn Lance Stroll and say that he is an absolute terrible driver, the worst in the entire existence of motorsport going back a century. And then I've had plenty of people in the comments telling me that the live stream was completely littered with anti-Stroll comments. Some of it just completely blind, irrespective to all of the good stuff that he did. And I can't imagine that would have been satisfactory to the people who were already fans of GT World Challenge. Yeah, all those newcomers, you would have just shown up your ignorance. But unfortunately, for those who just wish to continue the narrative that Lance is absolutely terrible, well, overall, he was not. When he actually could put it on the track and not get track infringements, considering this is the first time he's been in a GT car for a very, very, very long time, he actually was putting in times that were respectable. In some cases, in the top 10. And you gotta think about this. This was all organized within the span of a week. This was not something that was planned for weeks and weeks and weeks. In fact, whenever you hear Max talk about it, especially back in Le Mans Virtual a few years ago, all of this could easily take months of preparation. Stroll, he got this done in days, and he managed to actually produce some solid times. In fact, all of this just sounds to me like a racing driver has suddenly rediscovered something, that, you know what, life is worthwhile after all, that it's not all about Formula One, and that should make the commercial side of that sport utterly terrified. Yes, it's Lance Stroll, not everybody's favourite driver, but it's still now representing nearly 10% of the grid deciding to go, you know what, Formula One doesn't have to be the only thing that defines me, you know. And he said he'd like to do more of these races if he feels like he's able to or if he has the time. And he said all of this with a big smile on his face. He didn't say the same thing about Formula One though, which I shall share with you for your consideration. Ahem. In Formula One, you don't always have the opportunity to win. Here, if everything comes together, winning is possible. That doesn't really exist in Formula One. That's also a big motivation for me to be here. Pretty damning if you ask me. And look, please, don't dismiss this because Lance is the one that said it. He is still an active F1 driver, saying all of this in a press interview on the record, saying that winning really doesn't exist where he works. It's not because he lacks talent, although I am not saying he is the most talented driver on the grid, because he is not. Or that Aston Martin have just been unlucky, that's why they're at the back and not scoring any points, because they have very much shown, as well as Honda, there are plenty of inadequacies within that HQ. It's mainly because this year's hierarchy has been set so decisively and fixed there so efficiently by the architecture of the regulations that those outside, say, the top three or four teams of the grid have basically been told where their ceiling is right now. P7 if they're lucky. So the Canadian borrowed a helmet, drove to Paul Ricard, and put in a top 10 pace in a car he'd never raced before. It wouldn't surprise me if we get more of these forays from other drivers in due course. And while that was happening, the FIA single-seater director Nicholas Tombassis sat down with the press and gave his present read on the regulations, likening them to a hospital patient. In his mind, said patient was not in intensive care. Instead, his diagnosis was that they just needed to eat a few more apples and not worry about open-heart surgery and the like. Now, hang on a second, folks. I know you are going to be absolutely furious by that analogy, but you know what? He's not wrong, nor is he protecting anyone. He's one of the most informed people out there regarding the 2026 regulations. Since Ben Sulliam's not been talking about them as of late, it's always been Nicholas has always been talking about it. He is the chief of single-seater racing within the governing body of Formula One. He has been there at every single meeting to do with these regulations and every single interaction with teams and manufacturers and drivers. He was there when these regulations were being discussed years ago, from day one. He knows exactly who pushed for what and what compromises were made to get to where we are today and where it's going to go going forward. He's also telling you that the structure he operates inside can't deliver open-heart surgery right now, even though I think secretly he would love to, but he realistically can't, as I will explain later on in the video. Because buried in that same interview, there was a man who actually said that certain risks and concerns with these regulations had been identified quite a ways before the crash that Behrmann had in Suzuka. You know, the risks of speed differentials and how things could easily turn into accidents or misunderstandings. There were discussions, but they just weren't acted upon at the time, because in his logic, making rush decisions too fast too soon may end up making things worse or might lead to something really, really going wrong. Which honestly is a somewhat reasonable defensive position, but it doesn't excuse him wholesale. A documented safety concern, formerly discussed by the people responsible for the sport's governance, became a 50G impact and a driver in the wall before anyone moved. And while certain commentators were quick to shout down Colapinto as the one at fault, Behrmann's own boss didn't give that take the time of day, and cited the regulations as the cause. It's a good thing Oliver walked away, albeit shakily, because the next time, they might not be so lucky. And the GPDA, the Grand Prix Drivers Association, didn't need the crash as proof. They'd already told the FIA in writing about their worries. After Suzuka, their response via Carlos Sainz was unambiguous, which I shall also share with you for your consideration. Ahem. As the GPDA, we warned the FIA these accidents will happen a lot with this set of regulations, and we need to change something soon if we don't want it to happen. I hope it serves as an example and the teams listen to the drivers and not so much to the teams and some people that said the racing is okay, because the racing is not okay. In fact, the Spaniard's been very, very consistent here. He's been trying to explain the physics of these regulations since the Australian Grand Prix, with increasing frustration regarding those who were listening and those who were not listening. He also specifically called out the gap to what teams recognise on the pit wall what the speed differences are to the drivers who are experiencing those same differences within the car. 50 kilometers an hour on a little map on a computer screen, it may not look that much different, but inside of a car, 30, 35 miles an hour difference, that is pretty noticeable. I'm a ladder man. I don't race cars for a living, and even I can go, yeah, I'm more likely to believe Carlos. And Suzuka provided the most valuable example for the Spaniard that maybe the FIA might decide to listen to the drivers a little bit more in this particular circumstance. But then his buddy Lando, within the same confines of the Suzuka media pen, was asked a similar question, whether or not the FIA will actually listen to the drivers. Lando just went, clearly not, two words, and then walked away. That pretty much embodies the frustration. No wonder those two decided to do a quadrant video together to rekindle Carlando. And nobody in the governance structure actually went out of their way to contradict Lando. So they sort of were agreeing. And there might be a reason why, because Esteban Ocon said something similar during the pre-season about how the drivers don't really have much of a say regarding the regulations and sometimes even their own car. He was asked how drivers manage energy deployment during a qualifying lap, and his answer was this. I would say it's 20 to 80. 20 on us, 80 on the engineers. 20%. The regulations have been written in a way that perhaps makes the driver a minority stakeholder in their own lap time. No wonder some of them are finding other places to go racing. In a GT3 at least, the driver has majority rule. But okay, the fixes, because there will be fixes. That's the important thing to understand here. But from the sound of it, we're not going to get the current powertrains ripped out of the chassis, which admittedly people do say is good. I mean, apart from the RB22, and then just stuffing in a naturally aspirated V8. No, that's not going to happen. At best, in a few years' time, 3, 4, 5, it's going to be a turbocharged V8. I'll take that. With carbon neutral fuels, I'll take that too. And Tom Bassett is also really, really clear here with his apples analogy that any changes this year, at the very least, are going to be not related to any adjustments to the hardware. So he is essentially saying, how do you like them apples? That may be adjusted in time, say next year or the year after that, to give many manufacturers time to adjust things, because I do suspect the blowback towards these cars will only continue to grow if very little changes, and instead, any changes will be related to the matter of software and how the car is actually managed. So we might not have as much emphasis regarding machine learning, which is just taking the control out of the drivers and when they want to or when they don't want to overtake. That being another Lando quip we heard from Suzuka. So, in a way, you could maybe consider this good news, that the software could be adjusted to where the drivers have more impact. I mean, that's the way Nicholas is framing this. It's absolute good news. There's less disruption from the computers and the software. He is right to say this. This can be done quickly, but what he also didn't say, and I doubt anyone really is going to be saying this after all of the meetings that will conclude by April 20th, is the ones who may stand to benefit from this. The advantage Mercedes has had this year isn't primarily aerodynamic. That seems to be Ferrari's territory. The performance gap between the Silver Arrows and everyone else seems to come from control software. They've been going on about it non-stop for months. Specifically, from the way Mercedes' power unit knows when to deploy electrical energy, how to distribute it across the lap, and how to manage the recovery cycle without surrendering pace on the straight. And not to mention that little qualifying trick that Red Bull also was able to emulate, that allowed them to have that little bit extra power, just a drop-off, which is actually meant to be a fail-safe in case there's a problem. No, it's being used to gamify a qualifying lap because, well, the cars, for 60 seconds, don't need to be going full chat during the cooldown lap. The FIA may go on to clarify that, saying you can't do that in qualifying unless there's a real problem and it will be investigated, but that's for another video. But my point is, they know how to make use of their power unit and the software. And another key differentiator here is that Oscar Piastri, who is driving a Mercedes-powered car, said in his own car he has to lift and coast sometimes 3 times a lap. And in some corners, he's running 450 horsepower less than the supplied Mercedes power unit. Same engine, completely different software depth. It's something I've been telling you time and time again since I realized this for myself. Yes, Mercedes, by the rule of law from the FIA, have to provide the same hardware and the same basic control software. But in terms of the secret stuff in how to get the most of that power unit, no. They don't have to provide that. They can keep that all to themselves. And all the stuff that those customers are providing the supplier, it's only going to accelerate their advantage. And if you think about it, Mercedes has been managing the whole thing about the ratio between the engine and the hybrid side for about 12 years now, since the turbo hybrid era began. In fact, it might be a reason as to why so many people are nettled about there being a hybrid battery in there at all. And that 2026 was the moment that just went beyond the pale. You know, the moment when they just couldn't ignore it anymore. Mercedes have been able to gather institutional knowledge that's only compounded over time. And the fix of the moment regarding software sophistication is software-controlled adjustments. So, that could easily be gamified if it's not codified into the updated rules and regulations for Miami. So whatever new settings come into play for the first American race of the season, the ones who have the deepest knowledge regarding the software side of the car will only stand to gain the most. That's just the way it goes. So then we've got to discuss who is actually going to be in the room. Toto Wolff and Fred Vasseur, sitting first and second in the constructors respectively, supplying 7 teams on the grid with power, are probably not rushing to dismantle what they spent hundreds of millions of dollars building. They're on notably good terms outside the paddock too, which makes the dynamic between them worth watching carefully. After Suzuka, Wolff addressed journalists directly, saying that only conservatives traditionally stand all stuck in the past could possibly dislike this, only to then acknowledge that qualifying was a problem and said he'd bring it up for the April 9th meeting. The races, though, he didn't flag those as a problem. Well, yeah, because Mercedes is winning those, although them getting towards those wins hasn't exactly been a bed of roses now, has it? One error here, one error there, one mistake here, one mistake there, or simply just not getting past at all. I still remember Oscar Piastri assessing all of the stuff that happened after Japan, when he could actually start a race, and said, oh yeah, That Mercedes advantage is nothing special. As in, they can be beaten if the right upgrades and right understanding of the rules applies to a team. Vasseur's position is different, but it's also equally clear, and it's all to do with the manner of the turbocharger they put in, a very small one, which has been able to help them really, really well in terms of race starts, and it's Ferrari flexing their own weight within the FIA and Formula One. Over history, Ferrari's constantly threatened the sport that they will walk away if things don't go their way to a certain extent. And this time it comes around from a sort of reluctance and stubbornness, digging their heels after initially bringing out a problem regarding start line procedures a year ago, but the other teams decided to ignore it. Then when it actually became a problem in testing, and slightly before that, everyone else was up in arms going, "Oh God, there could be a real start of the problem! We haven't got a problem! Ferrari, please, have mercy!" And Fred was like, I'm not going to have mercy, and I just told you before, but enough is enough, and during the landing season, no, he was not willing to play ball there, and why should he? He brought it up, he came up with a solution, his team, so why should he have to suffer the consequences for people deciding to ignore him in the first place? But it's not surprising, really. They're doing what anyone in their position would do. Self-preservation to the hilt. You spend upwards of $1 billion making sure that your car has a fair shot with these brand new regulations, make sure your framework and understanding of them are absolute or as competitive as possible, so you can either be the second best or the best. And then when someone wants to get rid of all of that, you're not just going to go, okay, yeah, sure, fine. And all of this happening 3 races in? No, you're going to resist. And this is precisely the position the FIA finds itself in. You've got to remember here, folks, the FIA doesn't handle Formula One alone. They are the International Federation of Automobiles. They deal with 160 different motorsporting series globally. Formula One is the jewel in the crown, but there are many others that need the time of day and the attention of many people within the meant-to-be non-profit organization. Formula One is the biggest motorsport on the planet. It's also the one where the people with the most influence over any regulation discussion are the same people who benefit most from those regulations staying exactly as written. Sure, Tom Bassett can draft rules and can be meetings, he can even make cute medical metaphors. But what he can't do is compel teams with Ferrari's contractual veto rights and Mercedes' commercial and political heft to accept structural changes that those teams have already decided are against their interests. Well, I mean, not without a fight at least, or a decent compromise that they could still benefit from at least. Or, and let's hope it doesn't come to this, blood on their hands. And last week's meeting that we thought was going to be the moment where things came to a head? No, not really. It ended up with warm words, no drama, and then there were going to be more meetings. There was going to be some on the April 15th and 16th slot, and then 4 days later on April the 20th, things will be ratified between the teams and the power unit suppliers and many other personalities and stakeholders. That's when we'll get an idea about what could happen by the time we finally get back racing again. That is including the commercial side, FOM. And every single statement I've seen from the FIA as of late has not really been talking about reform of these regulations or an overhaul or a major adjustment. The watchword of these statements I've heard from Nicholas Tombassis' side have been mainly things to do with tweaks, and tweaks aren't sexy. And in fact, I can easily imagine people reading all of this might be tweaking themselves right now. Instead, Tombassis floated a Phase 1 and Phase 2 approach, giving manufacturers a little more time in Phase 2 for further adjustments. And the bigger changes, anything touching the fundamental power split or engine architecture, won't come this year. 2027 at the earliest, I think. So another 7 or 8 months of drivers asking whether or not Formula One is worth it anymore. Of the FIA asking for a consensus for people who actually hold veto rights, so they are very much up against a brick wall who may or may not decide to throw a brick in their direction. And Verstappen's contract, as we all know, does have an exit clause if he's not in the top two, and now, at this precise moment, he is nowhere close to that. In fact, he is almost about to fall out of the top 10. He's already having a lot of fun at the Nürburgring and giving other Formula One drivers advice, most likely, even Lance Stroll. And he's even likened Formula One to a situation where he has a battery of motivation which runs out very quickly after having started at full for the first Grand Prix with that slight bit of hope that maybe it might not be so bad, the thing that he'd been worrying about all these years, and then realizing, oh no, it is that bad. And whether it was intentional or not, it might be the way best to summate all of the drivers' feelings of the 2026 regulations, that they are starting off with a sense of hope, but over time, that hope may start to discharge. But I must stress this out to you all, Tombassis isn't the problem here. He said something honest in that interview. More honest than what most of what comes out of the senior levels of this sport produce. Which I must share with you for your consideration. So you're getting three of these in one go. Ahem. I don't know if it often happens when you're a director or a referee to be patted on the back all the time. We usually get criticized and we're old enough to know that. He's right. He's not going to get a pat on the back if things are changed back in the way of the drivers. The best I think he'll get is a good. Glad we're clear on that. It shouldn't have been like that in the first place. Now do your job. Other than that, it'll just be critique after insult after I don't know what. If the tweaks don't work or they aren't as obvious, he's going to get blamed for it. And he won't be praised if they successfully, Formula One, get through this political minefield and come up with something that, hey, actually is not too bad at all with some adjustments. It's a shame, really. He's doing his absolute best to what he can do with the might of these manufacturers. It was bad enough in the 2000s, but given how popular Formula One is right now, and manufacturers beating down the door to maybe participate, and sponsors beating down the door and having a lot of influence, and Toto Wolff having a lot of political heft, this is far more challenging to try and convince regulation change with Formula One than, say, maybe even FIA World Endurance Championship. I mean, that's still a blue ribbon event for the FIA, but you feel like they are at least a little bit more equal in terms of, you know, stature. But the questions that any press release will not be able to answer will be the questions that are pitched at the final meeting on April 20th. The FIA can acknowledge the problems and appeal for broad consensus in press briefings, and the people with the power to actually change the architecture of the sport will most likely sit in the room on that meeting and agree to the bare minimum version of change that keeps the thing moving without threatening their advantages. Not really caring, seemingly, if fans walk away or not. You know, despite the fact that F1 is only as popular as it is now and as huge as it is right now due to having lots and lots of fans, and if fans start to walk away in their droves, which they are doing so right now, that will gain more and more attention. And eventually, if a certain amount of fans walk away from the sport, sponsors and partners of Formula One may decide to reconsider their options or maybe walk themselves. I can easily imagine that Apple is looking at all of the statistics and graphs and charts and all of the promises that Stefano Domenicali offered them in 2025 when the ink was written for that exclusive deal in the US, and what's going on in 2026 with the viewing figures dropping? I can easily imagine that Tim Cook's going to Stefano saying, "Good morning, what the hell?" Meanwhile, the drivers will wait, but in time, they will decide to find other things to do. They will find other things to drive, like Lance Stroll just did, and he was able to make that happen within a week. What's stopping someone outside the top six going, "Oh, you know what, that thing looks pretty interesting, maybe I might go and do some of that, as long as it's not too dangerous." Because Lance's thing, that was so spontaneous, and it actually gave him a lot of joy. It might have actually rekindled something within him, that, hey, maybe I do like motorsport after all. It could do the same to somebody else. He found the best available version of his job at the moment in the south of France, and he went to Max Verstappen about who to call to make this happen, and the thing about that is that Max Verstappen already knew exactly who to call. And I call upon you next to go over to this video, which I think you will enjoy. I will just go and freshen up and I'll be right with you.